The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's August 7th, 2024. It's 2:37 in the afternoon. Let's get rolling. This is John Williams, and you have found the Mincing Rascals podcast. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
Hey, guys. Brandon Pope, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago on WCIU, and contributor to various platforms.
I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Marge Halperin. My commentary draws on years as a journalist and a political reform worker for various government agencies, running my own PR firm, and now you can hear me here and on Canada's CTV National News Network.
Well, the big story nationally is that our governor, J.B. Pritzker, did not get asked to be Kamala Harris's running mate. And Josh Shapiro in Pennsylvania didn't either. And Mark Kelly in Arizona didn't.
Did I? Neither did you. I thought you were going to do the whole list.
Well, no. Actually, you are the one, Marge, who when I asked, and Kate said it as well, but Marge answered first. I said, who do you like? And you were clear about it. It should be Kelly. And clearly it is not. So let's talk about the pros and cons of that. And then we'll catch up with Brandon, who was recently at the National Association of Black Journalists Convention in Chicago, where Donald Trump made all kinds of news. First, though, pros and cons. Marge, you spoke up first.
I have been just giddy about the whole thing. Watching their announcement rally in Philadelphia was just wonderful experience, was enough to drive me back to Twitter, where I don't like to be much anymore. But there was so much excitement. It was really fun to watch. And Walz himself said he's brought back the joy. And boy, we've been, I'm part of this progressive mobilization network through my work at Indivisible Chicago. And everyone's exchanging all kinds of facts about what Walz has done and who he is. And the more you learn, the better you like the guy.
Yeah. It's interesting how much the internet is working for the Democrats right now. Whatever campaign they're going to roll out, they almost don't need to get in the way of citizens and memes and lists and videos. It's sort of writing its own script right for them. Kate?
Oh, I think he's certainly a good choice. I think any of them would have been a good choice. And nobody is perfect. Everybody has potential drawbacks. So while Marge and I were both very big on Mark Kelly last week, he's apparently not known to be a good speaker. You know, he would not be getting out there creating the memes like Tim Walz is doing and creating this kind of huge momentum, apparently. So I could totally understand why they picked Walz, and he's got so much going for him. I'm very cautiously optimistic. And I would say the cautious part, because although he seems great in just about every way that I can see, everyone does have a drawback. So his drawback would be that instead of signaling to the swing state voters that are so important, who are going to determine the election, instead of signaling to them that the campaign is going in a more moderate direction that the swing state independents would like, it does indicate staying progressive, maybe even going farther left. And that's what they're going to get attacked on. There's always going to be something to attack on in this case.
And the George Floyd
basic stuff
story.
Seems like things that I think most people will really like. Free breakfast for school kids, free lunch for school kids, free college for people who are making less than $80,000 a year. A lot of terrific initiatives that they've been doing in Minnesota. But there are a few things that he will get attacked on.
A state that does have a budget surplus, too. So if that sounds spendy, they can afford it. He will be described as liberal and pushing the ticket that way. Not that Kamala Harris won't already get that tag. But the George Floyd story is also something that they're going to have to relitigate. Brandon, good pick?
I think it's a solid pick for them. And I think – really anyone that would have been picked is going to be called too far left, right? That's the strategy from the Republicans and Trump at this point. Everyone's radical. Everyone's part of the radical left. Remember, Joe Biden was part of the radical left, even though he's one of the most moderate Democrats of all time. So, like, that's the strategy. It's to be expected. I think Tim Walz is actually very fascinating because it's hard to find anything that is necessarily damning with his, you know, his career. If you want to talk about the George Floyd thing, Benjamin Crump, famous attorney who was big within the George Floyd case, has actually come out in support and saying that he enjoyed the work he had with Tim during that situation. He thought that he handled it well. He was working with the families and that he was pushing for reform throughout. So he's got at least the backing of those who were major in the George Floyd case and what was going on during it. But I'm fascinated by this campaign strategy. I think he fits the moment very well. They got 90 days at this point, a flash campaign, and it's right at the height of football season. It almost felt like watching that Philadelphia rally, like it was a sports rally of some sort, a pep rally for a sports team. And I think that was intentional. You kept hearing Kamala Harris talk about how they are the underdog. You kept hear her talking about Tim being Coach Walz several times. She said it like probably 17 times, right? She's trying to really put that linkage together. He's a football coach. He's a leader. He can get it done. This whole kind of full hearts, clear eyes, can't lose, Friday Night Lights energy. And it's fascinating because we're in the fall. Football season is coming up. They're going to need to get – I imagine they're going to be at the Big Ten football stadiums trying to get people. And Tim Walz appeals to Midwest nice. Midwest football season. They're already put the hats out with the camo. He's a gun owner. This was a play strategically at men, white men in particular, but men overall, to get them animated and activated behind a black woman, an AAPI woman candidate. And I think Tim Walz may be the perfect match when it comes to that. He also seems very satisfied in the role of number two, where it seems like others like a Josh Shapiro, the critique of them was that maybe they had aspirations for higher or may have tried to outshine or usurp Kamala Harris. With this situation, it feels like the perfect dynamic duo, perfect for the moment of memes and social media, the idea of joy and positivity, and the idea of moving forward as a country. So I think Democrats overall are very pleased with it. From the Republican sources I've talked to, they're not too happy with the pick. They would have liked to have had someone like Josh Shapiro, who they think would have torn the party up from inside because of the Israel situation. But with Tim Walz, you kind of dodge all of that to focus on the forward look for the country.
Republicans, a scroll I saw today was that I was watching Fox News that Governor Walz encouraged the rioting and looting. There's also talking points going out now that the fact that they passed over Shapiro is essentially an anti-Semitic move by the Democrats. You can understand why, I guess, if you're just looking at his faith. And maybe that was a factor. I don't know that I would call it anti-Semitic, particularly since Walz just seems to be such a natural, happy warrior. I don't know how much they knew about him. Did they know he was going to be that good or that the internet was going to just adopt him the way they have? But it really does seem like not only a safe pick, but now a strategic pick.
And for a 90-day campaign where you have to draw contrasts more than ever.
I think that's huge. I think that's huge, yep. Brandon, because, you know, my other thought, if I just may, is that when we play today, for instance, 60 seconds of J.D. Vance on the stump and 60 seconds of Tim Walz on the stump, and Vance is angry and conspiratorial and we're going to hell in a handbasket. And then there's this other guy smiling and making people laugh. And he's no rube. I mean, he's been an executive. He was a six-term congressman, 24 years in the National Guard. I mean, his resume stands up, but he's just so cheerful. The contrast jumps right out at you, doesn't it?
That issue about you know, leaving St. Paul and Minneapolis burning, you know, he sent in the National Guard. He's the one who quelled the violence
after
by
three
sending
days.
In the National
after,
Guard.
If I yeah, after three days. Didn't the mayor ask for help sooner? It's not hard to find the video of Minneapolis burning right now. And the thread is that for 3 days, the mayor and the police chief were asking for help, and he dithered.
Well, I don't know when the mayor actually asked and what they said about bringing it under control on their own. I think mostly cities prefer not to bring in the National Guard because it can intensify the response and, you know, raise the heat and not bring it down. So I think it's right to be sure that you're choosing the timing when it's necessary and that local officials are not able to handle it on their own. That's the way I'd like to see it in our city. And I think most people prefer not to have the National Guard in their streets.
The issue is that the Minneapolis mayor did ask for it on the first night. But apparently he called up and talked to Governor Walz verbally, asked for it that way. And then the next day there was something more formal that came from the police department. Governor Walz said that they didn't send the very specific detailed plan of what they would require the National Guard to do. Apparently there's something very specific that they are supposed to specify that they want. And I'm sure we're going to be reading a lot more about this. The police department, the fire department had emergency plans, didn't follow their own emergency plans, didn't set up a good command structure, didn't come up with a plan for that specific incident either. And it backed up Governor Walz's contention that they did not send the really necessary information that they're supposed to request
right.
in order to get the National Guard.
Suppose they owned it. Suppose they fell on the sword and said, okay, we screwed up. I just wonder, though, and not that they are, but I just wonder what we can extrapolate from that. That is, okay, you had this riot well up, and for a few days things were out of control at night. Does that mean you could not be president or would not be a good president? Like, what do you derive from that? It doesn't look good, but I'm not sure what it means in terms of what you ask for a president.
Here's one other interesting and relevant fact that I haven't seen widely publicized, but Walz was appointed by President Trump and serves as co-chair still of the Bipartisan Council of Governors, which is set up to advise the president and the cabinet on homeland security and national defense. So apparently Trump thought he was good on security and defense issues. Probably he wouldn't say that today, but he did appoint him to that really important panel, and Biden reappointed him. So this speaks not only to his credentials in terms of security, but also ability to appeal across the aisle, which is a good thing.
The NRA gave him a good score. He's a gun owner, and Guns and Ammo said he was one of the 20 best legislators in the Congress, but they've since changed their mind on that. They've downgraded him from an A rating to a great big fat F. And that happened before this announcement, but that's a reminder to me anyway that he really does cut kind of a broad swath of middle America. This is a guy who does, in fact, look like your coach or your dad. It's weird that he and Kamala Harris are almost the exact same age. He's less than a year older than her. He looks older than her, though. He said if you're the cafeteria monitor in a high school for 20 years, you don't have any hair left. That's just the nature of being a high school teacher. I don't know if those are prepackaged lines. Maybe they're ones he'd been using for years, but he's just so quick with the quip. I hope that they keep the high road, keep the cheerful, positive attitude, just for my own head's sake. But also, I think if he starts to, like at the rally in Philadelphia, he said he made a reference to J.D. Vance and the couch. And then he said, you see what I did there? And I'm like, I hope we don't get a lot of that. Let's not go there.
Yeah, I was going to point that out, John. It's kind of a double-edged sword. He can say such ridiculous things, and it kind of goes over people's heads at first, and then they laugh, and they don't take it that badly. But I have to admit that if it was Trump or Vance who had taken just to calling the Democrats weird, and then it turned into a meme among Republicans, you have to admit Democrats would be saying that's just childish name calling. So you're right. I mean, he's good at that, but I hope he doesn't lean too far.
Okay, but then about the word weird, we mentioned this last week. Brandon, what's your reaction to that? Is that name calling they should be above, or is that genius and it's working?
It's genius.
Kate says it's both.
sorry, that was for you, Brandon. You answered.
Well, I think it's genius because I think the Democrats so long have been trying to play nice, and what happens is they end up on defense more than they do on offense, and it puts them in a losing position. The reality is you got to speak the language of the people you need voting for you, and the people you need voting for you to say these people are weird is a pretty universal sentiment amongst your most ardent base, who just wants you to acknowledge that. Let's not treat this like it's normal. Let's not treat this like it's a level playing field. Let's just call it what it is. You don't have to have any high talking points or deep platform points about it. It's just weird. I think something as simple as that, it's really how simplistic the Trump campaign runs. Something as simplistic as that can really just have reverberation across the bases you need to go out and vote, especially Gen Z and millennials, who you really need to show up in force for you to pull off this win.
I don't think it's name calling. Well, it's not name calling in the way Trump is. I mean, he's making up monikers for people that are just plain mean, right? And crying Schumer or whatever he calls him. You know, I think he is very personal. Weird is an honest assessment. And I've seen Walls follow this up by saying things like, who thinks in middle America? Who is calling for an end to birth control? Who sits on a bar stool and says, what we need to do right now is prosecute women who seek an abortion? Who, like, these are all things that they claim America wants. Americans do not want these things. They're just weird. They're out there. It's the same as calling somebody radical or, you know, the things that they like to say about leftists. I would say in response to what your comments were earlier, Brandon, about pushing her ticket to the left, I was pretty impressed. Of course, I sit pretty far to the left myself. But if this is a moment, if you think that 2016 was a moment for the Christian nationalists and the radical right to really seize upon the dislike for Hillary Clinton, then why don't we take our chance and seize upon the dislike and fear for Trump and push our country toward those laws that are people first? There's so many things that are freedoms that Trump wants to push for corporations, freedom of regulation, while meanwhile they're putting a whole list of new regulations on American people. Why don't we take this window and push back a little bit? Since Clinton, Reagan, we've moved our country more to the right, where the middle isn't even the middle anymore. And that's what makes their policies weird.
There is a risk, though. There is a risk in doing it too much. Like John referenced, you hope that they keep a happy warrior momentum, right? And kind of keep the high road. Because the weird thing is more of like a, it's not scathing, but it's also something nobody wants to be called, right? It's one thing to be called mean or be called anything else. But if I call you weird, it hits in a different way. Like it talks about, it just makes you squirm a little bit. It works in a way that I think most people can relate to. And I think that's something that, to the Trump campaign's credit, it's something the Trump campaign has done well in 16, in 20, and I'd argue in 2024 as well, is just finding simple ways to cut across the base that get used over and over. Finally, the Democrats are reading that playbook and using it.
Well, I noticed that J.D. Vance yesterday used the word normal. He said, they're not normal. We're the normal ones. Evidently, that seems to be sticking a little bit.
While I agree with you, Marge, that it would be very heartwarming to see them really emphasize more progressive things. At the same time, we do have to keep in mind that it's not really people who are reliable Democratic voters that they need to be focused on. That's one of the reasons that it is, to a lot of people, worrisome that they didn't pick Josh Shapiro, for instance, because they have to be focusing on that sliver of undecided voters in the swing states, that's not necessarily the way to get them. In fact, it probably isn't. Probably they need to de-emphasize how progressive Walz's governorship has been. Of course, we're from Illinois, and a lot of what he's been doing, we have been doing or starting to do in Illinois, like protect abortion rights and things like that. The big red flag I saw that you know they're going to be attacking him on is that he did sign legislation to make Minnesota kind of a trans sanctuary state for children who say they're in a situation with two parents who disagree about whether the child should have gender-affirming treatment, medical interventions like puberty blockers or hormone treatment. If one parent who wants to give the child that treatment takes them away to Minnesota, Minnesota is saying, we will not honor a court order from another state to return that child because we believe they should have gender-affirming medical intervention. Now, that's very controversial.
Yeah, but how far does that go? You can dig in and find a thing. But when you're looking at the whole litany of ways that Trump wants to take away our rights and our freedoms, and you look at the whole litany of things that were done in Minnesota, and then there's this one thing you kind of, you know, rather not, but it doesn't really affect your life for most people. Who doesn't want paid family and medical leave? Who doesn't want big investments in affordable housing, codifying abortion rights, clean energy, removing lead pipes? Like, he, within his first 100 days and with only a one vote margin in the Senate, he passed all that and more in the Minnesota Miracle Package. And yeah, there probably was that transgender law in the middle of that. But I, you know, when you look at trying to take away our right to health care, and not just women's reproductive care, but eliminating Obamacare, where 18 million people now rely on that for their health care, you know, taking away affordable housing, deporting people who are here waiting for asylum. I also don't think that transgender issue is so different from gay marriage and gay rights a couple decades ago. And look how our country
The commercial they're going to run on the Republican side isn't going to mention all that good stuff, Marge. I was really surprised at Simone Biles when she said, I love my black job after winning the gold. And that was a direct shot at something that came up, Brandon, at the National Association of Black Journalists convention. Now, you were there and you felt it was inappropriate for you to speak maybe for the organization right afterwards. Well, you're the president of the Chicago chapter. It was the national organization that put on the event. But just catch us up for a minute to the degree you're comfortable with what happened there. What was that room like? I was asking the gang here about the laughter that we heard in the room and what was the mood of the people that were taking it all in. The rascals kept mincing, but this is John Williams, and I want to remind you of this. Ottawa is the middle of everywhere. Enjoy all the boating, biking, and hiking in Ottawa's fresh outdoor space. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms. Everything from established hotels to luxury resorts to private rentals and B&Bs. Plan your trip today at visitottawail.com. This message brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Okay, now back to this edition of The Mincing Rascal.
Yeah, the mood was like nothing I've ever experienced before. I've covered many Trump rallies in 2016 in particular throughout Michigan and Indiana and Wisconsin. So I understand Trump. I've seen Trump in action. But in a room like this of black journalists who know the facts, who are well equipped on the facts, to have him sit there just from the beginning and start lying and start demeaning a black woman journalist, it put a lot of us in the room at unease, because what are you supposed to do? this is a professional organization. You are professional journalists. Yet there were so many untruths out there, and the organization did not set up a format where all these great journalists in the room would have the opportunity to ask questions and challenge those things. It was only up to those three moderators up there. And frankly, while I think they did a good job at points, there were some moments where many of us wanted to interject and some of us yelled and did. Like when he said something about abortion in 9 months, like that was one where like it didn't get any pushback from the moderators up top. And me and a bunch of others are like, that's a lie. Like, that's not true. So the laughter you heard in the audience was, I think it was unbecoming. I don't think it was a good idea, but it was just the honest reaction of people in the room who just knew on its face, Trump saying, I'm the best president for Black Americans since Abraham Lincoln. That's an absolute joke. Like, you
that
know,
works at the rallies, though. That works at the rallies.
It skips Johnson, who signed the civil rights law and the voting rights laws, which
Scott mentioned.
Did say, yeah.
It works at a rally, and this was no rally. Now, what disturbed me the most about this event, though, is it did get hijacked. Anybody can buy a registration for the NABJ conference. You don't have to show a press badge or anything. And there were people who were Trump supporters who did attend. So there was cheering inside that room. I don't know if it was heard on the live stream, but there were many moments where we heard a, that's my president. Or, yeah, that's right. And all of us kind of look around like, who is cheering right now? This is not a, whether it was Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris or Trump, the way these events go when both candidates are offered and they come to these conferences, it's not a cheering session. It's not a rally. We're there to cover it. And so to hear people cheering it like a rally was very disturbing. Overall, the mood was tense, disturbing. Many had their own different opinions on whether it should have happened or not. Obviously, some local Chicago journalists, too, had some strong opinions about that. Mm. I'm not going to wade into that debate because I think ultimately both candidates had to be asked to be there. We're a journalism organization. But you saw this organization grapple with two of its biggest identities butting heads. The advocacy end for Black journalists in particular versus the journalism end about we got to cover and cover fairly. Trump has been seen and is a candidate who has targeted Black journalists and has been dangerous for Black journalists. And so for some in the organization, they had felt like inviting him there and having him there, especially in Chicago, a place he has a relationship with that's not great, was an insult to Black journalists and put Black journalists in harm's way. Where you had others on the other end who said, hey, we can't run away from Trump. The way to cover Trump is not ignoring him.
Which were you, Brandon? Which were you?
Oh, he said he didn't want to get into this.
I can see both sides of it, and I completely am empathetic to the concerns from those who felt like this put Black journalists in harm's way, especially here in the city of Chicago.
Well, so, if by harm you mean physical danger, then I can't comment on that, but I'll just offer this. I think it was the right call. As uncomfortable or awkward as it was, Kate talked about platforming last week, and you guys didn't just give them an unfettered platform. There was pushback, and those were tough questions, nasty questions, as he said. So I don't think the organization came off badly. And if I may just comment on this also, somebody said to me afterwards that, well, you just now, Brandon, said it was weird to see him talking that way to Black journalists. It was suggested to me he wasn't talking to Black journalists. He was talking to everybody else. He was talking to those people who he wants to vote, and you guys were a prop for that. What's your thought about that, Brandon?
Yeah, ultimately, he had a message he wanted to carry. I do think saying things like Kamala Harris just became Black, like that's not for the people in that room.
You think?
That's one of the laugh lines. People in that room laughed audibly because it's like, this woman went to the blackest of Black colleges in America in Howard. She's part of one of the blackest of Black sororities, the AKAs. She very much identifies as a Black woman.
It's always been on her resume.
Always. So this impetus, though, that statement he did and that wedge he's doing, there's a lot of history behind it. There's a lot of tensions between the AAPI community and the Black community historically, especially people of South Indian descent and Black people. And I think he was intentionally playing upon that. And this idea of, which his message to Black people is, people are coming for you and your Black jobs, whatever a Black job is. I'm the person who is going to help you maintain your Black job, even though he can't define what a Black job is. He's telling a whole room of journalists that immigrants are going to take their jobs. Doesn't really communicate. But yeah, ultimately, you're right, John. His message was not for Black journalists. There was nothing in there for Black journalists. His message was trying to communicate writ large the Black people that he hopes to pull away while also replaying his greatest hits. And I think some of his answers were revealing. Him not knowing the Sonya Massey case, him waffling on qualified immunity for police officers in cases like Sonya Massey, right? Or with the January 6th insurrectionists, people who injured police officers. Like, the responses are there, and he seemed dumbfounded. If he cared about the Black community, he would know about Sonya Massey. He would have an agenda for that, and there was nothing present. I think the Harris campaign was probably very happy with what they saw.
I love that meme that shows Tim Walz in his fishing gear and camo hat and everything and says, this is an REI hire.
Yeah, by the way, I get it.
For a moment.
By the way, speaking of the Sonya Massey case, last month, Sangamon County Sheriff's deputies were called to check on a possibly suspicious person at the home of Sonya Massey. We've talked about that story here. After a slightly unusual but non-confrontational interaction with the deputies, Massey was asked to turn off her stove. She turned off the stove, then picked up a pot of what looked like hot boiling water, maybe, and said, I rebuke you in the name of Jesus. And the officers turned violent. And then in a matter of seconds, she was shot at short range, dead. The more we learn about Deputy Sean Grayson, the more we ask, how is this person even ever hired? I have heard back this week from a PR person that represents the state's Law Enforcement Training and Standards Board. We've been told that they are tasked with ensuring the bad candidates or officers don't get hired or rehired. But this person that was speaking on the board's behalf said that, in fact, they don't have that authority and that the Safety Act, which does give them some discretionary power, is vague on enforcement details, and there's nothing they could have done about Sean Grayson's getting hired in Sangamon County. Today, Governor Pritzker says the Sangamon County Sheriff should resign. Kate, should the Sangamon County Sheriff resign? Should he quit his job?
That's a little unclear to me. He was apparently popular before this. He ran unopposed for re-election. After Sonya Massey got murdered, he has said all the right things that you would want a sheriff to say under these circumstances. He's gone to the big meetings and said, I will say her name. We made a mistake. We messed up. We have to fix this. So he has said all the things that you would want him to say. He has said he wants to fix it. So you've got that on one side. And then on the other side, how bad and irresponsible is it that they hired Sean Grayson? That's just a little bit unclear to me if Grayson may have been, on such a dividing line that it would have been hard for them to know for sure that he was going to blow up in an incident like this. Yeah, he had two DUIs. That was before he got certified. So he was certified by the Illinois board.
He was dismissed from the military. He was dismissed from the military. And that doesn't show up.
Otherwise, I'm just saying, he otherwise had a good record besides the DUI. We should be finding out a little bit more about his employment record at the places where he actually was employed.
Well, maybe in the abstract.
From what I can see, he didn't actually get disciplined. He was told, for instance, after that high-speed chase, that he didn't stop when he was told to, and he crashed into a deer, apparently. He didn't get disciplined for that.
I just don't know why there isn't an online database that you just click in.
Right. Agreed.
If you want to get a job at Walmart, they'll screen you. It can't be that hard.
I'd like to sort out a couple of issues here. First of all, there is a database that is available as of the 2021 law, is available to police departments. If you want it to be public, you have to FOIA all 900 police districts or however many they are. So other states, most notably like Florida and Georgia, have public databases and anyone can access. We'd have to FOIA to get ours. But I think there's a deeper problem here that is traceable to the police culture or any kind of industry culture. I don't know if it's just police, but we have this picture of police protecting each other. We know that they falsify their records in many cases to protect, whether it's Laquan McDonald, Murder, or others, to protect fellow officers. So if they aren't willing to put the information into the discipline record, which I think is part of what you're getting at, Kate, then no one will ever know. And I have to say that I ran a nonprofit some years ago where the administrator that I inherited was an embezzler. And it took me a little while to find out. It was a big, ugly experience for our little nonprofit. And I looked back at where she had worked before and saw that she was unemployed for some period of time. And I called them. Did you have this problem with her? And they're like, you know, there were problems. I can't really say. I don't, you know, they. So if you check her references, no one's going to say. And then I look up, where is she now? She's working for another nonprofit. And I let them know we'd taken her to court. You know, like, you have to stand up with the responsibility to report about what has actually happened. And I think too many police departments are not willing to tell the truth on the record of their employees. They protect each other and let them shuffle off.
Well, that's what the sheriff in Springfield said, that this was not made available to him. He literally just didn't know it. It would seem to me like if you have 6 jobs in 4 years in that industry,
that's a flag. That's when you're hiring anybody, isn't that? There's one other thing, John, I was going to say, is that my husband used to work in the Chicago Public Schools and was involved in hiring and training teachers. And they had a system of looking for red flags. They took time to spend time with people. They'd take them to lunch. They would have group activities. They'd watch their interactions with others, and they would see if behaviorally they were suited to be in a classroom. And they had a checklist of red flags they'd look for. That seems far more responsible and careful and detailed than the hiring of most police officers, and as far as I can see from these instances, when we only get to look in hindsight.
Well, then I got an idea. Maybe we should take the prospective hire and put him in one of those Chicago police cars that were driving around when Dexter Reed was pulled over, and see what they do in a situation like that. I'm segueing to one other police-related story here. I'll just read shortly from the Sun-Times. In the days and hours before a deadly shootout with Dexter Reed, tactical police officers conducted dozens of uneventful traffic stops on Chicago's west side, none of which appear to have generated so much as a ticket, as the Civilian Office of Police Accountability continues to investigate the March 21st shooting and the traffic stop that sparked it. The oversight agency has also launched a probe to determine whether those stops were unjustified. Body camera footage obtained by the Sun-Times shows that 5 officers who were involved in the shooting conducted 50 traffic stops between March 19th and the 21st, including 8 stops that were made in roughly 3 hours before they encountered Reed in the 3800 block of West Ferdinand Street. We all know what happened then. Reed resisted orders to roll down his window or get out of the car or open the door. He shot one of the officers. The 4 officers fired back 100 rounds, striking him 13 times. And we still don't know why the car was pulled over. Now, Brandon, does that catch us up on everything you know about this story?
I think we're up to speed. What we're seeing clearly is we need deeper examination within police departments of who's being hired and what their strategies are for enforcement. It's something that we've been calling for years. I mean, it's almost exhausting at this point.
Exhausting is the way to describe the research. It sounds like the Sun-Times did. They went back then and got the body camera footage of the 50 previous stops to see how the cops were interacting with these people. And it wasn't clear why the people were being pulled over, sometimes for no apparent reason. Otherwise, it might have been for a tinted windshield, or maybe you weren't wearing your seatbelt. But all of those seemed to just be a reason to stop and search somebody. And that's what these guys were doing all of the time. Brandon is shocked to hear that the police would be doing that on the south side.
I think it just shows still the lack of a comprehensive and productive policy to manage police discipline. These renegade cops, you know, how long are they going to be allowed to go when the culture sort of supports it? as I said earlier, then when they get caught with something, they'll falsify their records. I still don't get how they can change in court the reason for the pullover when the officer said it was failure to wear a seatbelt. And then when you could see the tinted windows, everybody could see that couldn't be possible. Now in court, the lawyers for the city just say, well, no, it was because the windows were too dark. The standards are so roughshod, it seems, once they get caught.
Has anyone here ever seen a police stop downtown or in River North or in any North Side neighborhood? I find it's rare. I rarely ever see it. And I know for a fact, because I've been in many Ubers and in many taxis, there's people not wearing seatbelts. There's people driving crazy. There's people violating traffic
laws. Look at their phones.
Downtown, you can't even get a cop. We can and have rap on a police officer's window and they're just pulled over and say, look at all these illegal parking. They're blocking the bike lane. They're whatever. Can't you? And they just tell you repeatedly. They either say, oh, what are you going to do? Well, you're a cop. I know what you could do. Or they say, you know, mayor doesn't like us. We're not going to do anything for her. We used to hear during Lightfoot. You know, you know, the answer to your question is I haven't seen it.
I did get pulled over for my husband not wearing a seatbelt, and he was sitting in the back seat. I was like,
wow.
How is this my fault?
Who gets the ticket? Do you get the ticket or does your husband, the driver?
I got the ticket. It was weird.
Was that downtown, Kate? Was that in the city?
Calumet City, I want to say. I think it was Calumet City.
That's pretty remarkable. Wherever that happened, here on Earth, that's pretty. That's eagle eye policing, I'll tell you. I was thinking if you do 50.
It doesn't really matter either way it sounds.
Oh, absolutely. But if you do 50 in 3 days, maybe when you're writing the report, you go, hey, Bob, which was this? Was it the tinted windows or the seatbelt?
The one where we killed that guy, or was this just the guy we couldn't find a reason to give him a ticket?
But also in this case, I mean, as we've discussed before, the pretextual traffic stops went way up after the Chicago police were forced by an ACLU lawsuit to stop doing more stop and frisk of pedestrians.
What does that mean, Kate? Pretextual.
A pretextual is so they're not observing you, say, blowing through a stop sign, like what I get my tickets for. They're observing something that's not of any danger to anyone, like a rear light that's out. But the real reason for stopping you is that they want to maybe look around and see if they see any guns or drugs in your car.
And do we want them to do that, I think, is also a question.
That is the question. That is the question.
And honestly, I wonder how they are. It's maybe like if you go fishing 50 times, a couple times you might catch a fish. So I wonder if that's the strategy there and what to make of it. How else are they going to find the bad guys if they don't do pretextual stops?
I'm looking at a report from the Chicago Council of Lawyers, which calls those pretextual stops a pipeline to police testifying. That would be instead of testifying, it sets them up to lie about what they're doing and why. But the number of traffic stops in Chicago have increased dramatically to Brandon's point, I wonder what the distribution is around the city. But in 2015, they were 86,000. And in 2022, they're up from 86,000 to nearly 500,000. I think Kate's probably right that it's become a police department policy. And that is yet another aspect of this that we ought to know more about.
Brandon, before we let you go, I'll let you comment on any of that. I also wanted to ask if you've been watching the Olympics. I've got a question for you. But
tough segue. But I just hope and pray that at some point soon we get some real comprehensive reform, meaning a full look at department policies, whether pretextual stops should still be mandated, what that looks like. Maybe some should, some shouldn't. A better sense of like creating a culture within policing that respects humanity and people.
Did you tell us once before that you had covered the Olympics?
Sure did.
Were they the Summer Games?
The Summer Games in 2012 and 2016 in Rio.
Do you think that if a female boxer tests too high for levels of testosterone, that she should fight as a female, a male, or not at all in the Olympics?
John Williams with the tough questions. I think the misinformation that spread around it was unfortunate.
Yeah.
And I do believe that this is kind of a standard thing. This happens. And it doesn't mean that anyone is trying to change their gender or cheat the system necessarily in any way.
That's not the case this time. Nope.
The type of supplements you may take sometimes have added levels of testosterone. The supplements I take when I go to the gym that probably have testosterone in them as well, right?
Well, she's not trans and she wasn't taking supplements. She just happens to be born that way, is my understanding. And she did fight and she did win. And at first I said, if you have too high a level of testosterone, then you should not compete as a female. But the more I talked about it with colleagues and listeners, I was persuaded that, look at Michael Phelps. He is a biological freak of nature, made to swim faster than any other human. He's got every advantage but gills. So if a woman happens to have a high level of testosterone and that makes her a better puncher, lucky her, but that doesn't mean you should disqualify her. So that's where I sit on that this week. Okay, buddy, I know you got to go. We'll tap you out now. Thanks, man.
Hey, see y'all.
I don't think we've actually talked about this before.
She doesn't compete as a female?
No, the two boxers we're talking about, as far as we know, it appears that they probably have the disorder or difference in sexual development, is the technical term for it, that Caster Semenya did, the Olympic runner, mm-hmm. where they are biologically male. Genetically, they have XX chromosomes. I'm sorry, XY chromosomes. So they are biologically male, but they have a genetic mutation so that as embryos, they do not process the testosterone in a way that they develop male genitalia. So when they're born, they look, to someone who's just taking a cursory look, like they're girl babies, female, genetically female babies. And in a lot of countries, especially countries that don't have a really modern medical system, they're going to be raised as girls, and nobody has any idea, including them, that they're not fully genetically, biologically female. So I really feel for these athletes, definitely. A lot of them are shocked sometimes when they find this out. But it's not fair to the biological females. That is why we do have that division in the sports, because anyone who's gone through male puberty does have a huge, huge advantage over the females. And that is what happens to these people with these particular disorders that we're talking about. They have internal testes, and when they hit puberty, they undergo pretty much the exact same puberty that that other boys do. In many countries, these people may decide to switch and continue the rest of their life as a male instead. But they have gotten those male advantages of a larger heart, larger lungs, different skeletal differences that make them stronger. Especially when it comes to boxing, there is really no other sport in which it is more important that biologically people do not get in the ring with biologically female people.
I completely changed my view, and now it's not the Michael Phelps analogy. It is everything you just said. Now I'm on your team.
Can I give you one more thing on that, though?
Yeah.
I was reading a terrific article in Quillette. There's a particular Olympic female swimmer who medaled in the Olympics, but you can compare her directly with another male athlete swimmer. She's got like the same wingspan and all that stuff that makes Michael Phelps such a, you know, dominant force in swimming. So they have exactly the same height, weight, wingspan, etc. But he is phenomenally better because he has the male advantages that, sure, you look at her and she is just an amazing physical specimen, and she's amazingly muscled, but she still cannot possibly compete with a male who has the exact same, specifications, because she doesn't have the same size heart. She doesn't have the same size lungs.
Doesn't have the testosterone,
like
yeah. Well, yeah. The fact the woman that you referenced earlier was then told that she would have to either take estrogen or something to reduce her
testosterone.
Her testosterone right. levels, so that she would better biologically or genetically be female. But she had to do that if she wanted to, which just seems ludicrous to me.
That's how a lot of sports dealt with it for a while, but it doesn't take away the advantages that the puberty did give them.
Meanwhile, I mean, it might take away, developed.
Like, you know, I'm not digging as deep as Kate did on this, but if I look at it from a 30,000 foot, you know, view, the Olympics celebrate diversity. They celebrate overcoming adversity. The stories about Suni Lee having two kidney ailments and coming back to be part of the team that wins the gold. You know, we cheer all that. And I don't know, this obsession with gender is, you know, is a deep rabbit hole to me. I think on the one hand, I can't play volleyball. I'm 5 feet tall. I don't get to play volleyball. I just don't get to. There's no accommodations for me. And you don't rule out people who are excessively tall and say you can't play volleyball because you're too tall. You know, that's just like lucky you, or like your Michael Phelps example, you know. And I just think I know a young girl who from a very young age, I watched her grow up as an amazing gymnast. Then in puberty, she shot up. Yeah. Too tall for gymnastics. Yeah. Couldn't do it anymore. She didn't get any accommodation or any, you know, too bad. She was so talented, but suddenly at 13, 14, she was too tall to manage the flips on a balance beam. Like, I just think there are differences among people and nationalities and skills and
backgrounds.
Physicality and backgrounds, all of that is supposed to be celebrated at the Olympics. And when we stop and splinter factions over these gender issues, I think it's contrary to the fundamental principles of the Olympics.
Okay, now I've changed my mind. I'm completely
with Marge, right? Now.
I'm back on the Michael Phelps analogy team. Okay.
No, I have to pull you back, John.
Oh, wait. Okay, fine, I'm easy. Go ahead. Hey, take a shot. I'm available.
The whole point of the female-male boundaries in sports, as we said, is because males 100% have such an advantage over females. Let's remember that even the most elite female Olympic champions, their world records are completely shattered every year by thousands of teenage boys, because that's how vast the differential is physically.
Well, then what do you do with that person then, Kate? So then where does that person compete against men then, or do they just not compete at all?
I would say they need to compete against men if they're biologically male, or in the case of World Aquatics, in their last set of world championships, they did try to set up a middle category, a transgender category, basically, that anyone could participate in if they were transgender or if they had a difference in sexual development. And they tried to set that up in every single category, but nobody signed up.
Marge, I'm completely persuaded by what Kate has said here, and we're going to end it on that one. Brandon Pope had to tap out, but we always appreciate his participation, particularly today. It was good to hear some of his takes on the Convention of Black Journalists in Chicago a couple weeks ago. Marge Halperin and Kate Plies. Eric Zorn's going to be back in town and joining us again next week. It's good to have all of you here this one. We're produced by Ben Anderson and Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week. Kate, digging deep on the history of Olympic athletes, had no idea. No. Man.
I'm really interested in the topic.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.